Football's summer break seems to get shorter every year. Now the Premier League season is back in full swing, and today I'm joined in the studio by someone who is every bit as excited about that as I am. Sue Chadwick, Arsenal fan and strategic planning advisor for Pinsent Masons LLP. In that order, I'm sure. Welcome, Sue.
Thanks, Jess.
And congratulations on the strong start to the season for the Gunners.
I think it's the first time in X number of years that we've had two wins in a row at the beginning of the season. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, brilliant.
How long can they keep it up?
Well, this is the thing about the beginning of the football season, isn't it? 2 weeks in and already Arsenal are, quote, back.
Yeah, Invincibles Mark II. Yeah,
that's right. Man, you are in crisis. I think we've got a long way to go and lots of soft tissue injuries between now and the end of the season. But yes, it's a really nice start. Yes,
lovely. Liverpool at the weekend, though.
Yes, and I'm travelling up to Liverpool at 6 o'clock on Saturday evening, so that's going to be an interesting journey.
And, of course, that's one of the famous old football stadiums in England,
yep, and
Anfield.
That's right, and it's one of the four areas that actually planning overlaps with football. So it's one of the things that I wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, because your interest in the beautiful game isn't solely recreational.
Not solely.
you have also managed to work it into the day job from time to time.
Well, it's not me working it into the day job. Football and football stadia particularly do come up in planning more than you realise. And not only are they actually in the vanguard of quite a lot of traditional planning law, I think they are leading the way in both the benefit and the problems associated with data, which is the final issue that I could talk about today.
Yeah, because that's what you're here to talk about. Sadly, we could talk about
football
for the full half an hour, but we're going to talk about some planning aspects as well. And obviously, football is big business. And with match day revenues are still a key component of revenue, which means that stadiums, or stadia if you prefer the Latin, are hugely important to that revenue. So barely a season goes by without talk of a stadium redevelopment or a club moving to a new development. So just this year we've had Tottenham Hotspur.
Do you have to mention Tottenham?
They finally moved into their new £1 billion home, which I'm sure you've heard a lot about after considerable delays.
And of course, the move to the Emirates was one of the reasons that the Arsenal slump was seen to be so prolonged. And so the stadia are important. And that was the first issue that I wanted to cover, really, which is assets of community value. Mm-hmm. They came in as part of the big society, the Localism Act, one of the main areas in the Localism Act. And they were very popular for a while there. And one of the areas where planning did sort of lead the way. Because two of the most famous assets of community value were the listing of football stadia and particularly stands. So Anfield is an asset of community value, it's listed as an asset of community value, and so is Man U, one of the stands there. Though I was looking through the case law, and actually the more interesting one is a much smaller stadium, which is Oxford City, where they were trying to get the stadium listed as an asset of community value. And the question came up was whether you could list it when football wasn't the only thing it was used for. And of course, the people who owned the stadium said it wasn't. It was only an ancillary use, so it couldn't be the reason for listing it. And I don't know whether the judge in that case was a football supporter, but he said, you know, football isn't just... it is true that there are only about 25 match days a year, but the cultural, recreation and sporting interests with which I'm concerned extend wider than the hour and a half or so for which 20 to 30 men play a game of football. And it's absolutely true. I mean, I look forward to the start of the season, but not just that, but the start of all the football podcasts, all the talk, you know, seeing match of the day every week as well. And he talked about the cultural, recreation and sporting interests. He said that it fosters community pride, stimulates daily conversations. Well, it certainly does that, and encourages the mix of generations. And I thought, well, yes, it does as well. Obviously, it's also a source of problems both off and on the gameplay. That there can be a way that quite difficult issues are discussed as well. But generally, I think people are happier once the football season starts. If you're a football supporter,
Just for anyone not familiar with the term, just sort of how do assets of community value? How does that process work, and what's the significance of a designation?
Yeah, well, what you have, you have to have a group of people, a community to start with. And for footballs, that's obviously the supporters club, and you've got that sort of community area already set up. But the asset must be a building or land. So much as they'd like to, Crystal Palace cannot designate William Zaha as an asset of community value. It is, and the criteria is not like a listed building. It's not design. It's not history. It is literally community value.
Yeah.
And the courts have talked about what that might mean in terms of planning. And what if you do get yourselves recognised as a group, and then you're able to establish that it does have a community value, and that the community value is likely to continue for some time, then what you have then is a right to have it listed on the council's website as an asset of community value, and then if that owner wants to sell, they have to offer the community group a chance to bid, and they have a protected period of 6 months within which, if they want to put a bid together, they can. I think it's Portsmouth where I don't know whether it's an ACV, but I think that's where the supporters sort of own the club as a result of it nearly becoming bankrupt. So it's something that could be quite relevant for a small football club to have that grace period of 6 months where they can try and raise the funds for it.
Because, of course, not all owners of football clubs necessarily run them with the best
interests of football,
yes. or the supporters.
Yes, just ask Newcastle.
It's a useful protection,
exactly,
for fans of football clubs to make sure their team has a home to call their own.
And that the community connection with the ground continues no matter who's running around on the pitch. So yes, it's one of those areas where nobody thought it would be relevant to football, but it became one of the big areas.
Because as you know, as an Arsenal fan, supporters do have a great connection to long-standing grounds, moving home can cause some degree of heartbreak, even if the new place is quite nice and shiny.
Though actually I've gone the other way with the Emirates. Now when I come back from visiting relatives in the north, and I see it's about 2 or 3 minutes out of King's Cross, you see the stadium and it's just like, yes, I'm home, I'm back. I'm back in London and there's the stadium. So I feel quite emotional about the new stadium as well, and that's the way it should be, I guess.
What would be the next planning issue that you want
Well,
to talk
I
about?
Think we're all familiar now with environmental impact assessments, but back in the day, I think the environmental impact assessments came in the way the GDPR is coming in now, which is that it comes in and you think, well, what can that possibly have to do with what we're doing in planning? And then suddenly you have a few cases and everybody's thinking, oh my goodness, this does affect me. I've got to start thinking about that. And two of them were related to football. So this is back in the early 2000s when the EIA regs were just starting to really kick in, and it's pretty much when Richard Buxton was cutting his teeth as well. That's how he made his name on these sorts of cases. And the first one was Ipswich. And there's a Bobby Robson connection between Ipswich and Barca, but I will at the end of this session be talking about another, as before unknown, connection between Ipswich and Barca. But this is one to do with EIA. Somebody called Rose Molstad really didn't like the idea of the proposal to extend the Portman Road Stadium. And she said that it was going to block light, and because it was going to block light, they should have had an EIA. They hadn't had an EIA, and she challenged it, and it went right up to the Court of Appeal. It was one of the early cases. Whether or not they get away with it now, I don't know. But in that case, the judge was pretty dismissive of her claim and said there's no magic number of property which must be involved there to be an environmental impact assessment. But it was one of the areas where EIA started to become something that all property owners needed to worry about. And also Brighton. And this isn't the current stadium. This is where they were when they were building the Amex, and they needed somewhere else to go.
Which was a long, drawn-out process,
exactly,
if I remember right.
Yeah, and this was simply the permission for the temporary stadium at Withdean.
Yeah.
While they were waiting for the Amex to be developed. And the council had said, well, we've done a screening for EIA, and we don't think it needs an EIA because of the mitigation measures, and that was challenged. And actually, the law has changed on gone back both ways on that sense on the mitigation measures. But at that time, it again went to the Court of Appeal, and they said it would be ludicrous to ignore conditions imposed on the frequency of football matches, the days on which they can be played, and the music which may accompany them when assessing the environmental impact. And, you know, they made the very good point that an activity involving thousands of people which occurs daily has more effect on the environment than one which occurs on a limited number of occasions a year and for no more than a few hours, which is interesting because that was back in 2007. Mm. And I think stadiums and clubs are getting bigger now and better at holding people for longer. Mm. And of course, there are far more matches. You know, this is one of the questions that comes up in terms of football every year as to whether or not we should have all of these matches. So, yes, it is one of the areas where planning led the way on being aware of an impact of something.
I do remember actually covering the case in my earlier years. But obviously, I mean, the environmental issues that are thrown up by football stadiums, as well as if stands get bigger blocking light, you've also got that problem of illumination in night games, and light pollution, you've got obviously noise.
Yeah, and that's where we sort of bring things really into the more modern day, because we are involved in a couple of developments, one of them being the Stratford Sphere, which isn't a sports, not a football stadium, but the GLA just issued the Stage 1 report on it and highlighted quite a few things that are, I think, relevant to planning and to football, because they are much more aware now, sadly, because of what has happened in the last couple of years about public safety. I mean, not just from crushes in the crowds, which we were already aware of, but now from proposed, you know, potential terrorism attacks. So that's an issue now with stadia that never used to be. And particularly the Sphere, they had to take into account activity at the London Stadium, which does bring us onto football. I think what I was amazed by, where they were looking at the stats for the footfall when there's a match, and they were said the station needs to absorb 775 entries per minute. Per minute on top of background use during a match day at its height. I mean, that is an enormous amount of people to absorb. And, you know, whether or not it's a temporary or permanent, it's something that is an absolutely material planning consideration. And then you've got, as you say, the light pollution, which is in people know about more. And as we get more aware of climate change and that becomes more relevant, the impact of the environmental impact and reducing that through use of LEDs and maybe renewable sources of energy. And you mentioned the forest green, the very green. I thought that was fascinating.
Forest green rovers, that was one of the ones this year. They're fully committed to reducing their
environmental
impact.
Or to being,
I think, possibly even a carbon neutral football club.
Yeah,
and I
so
think
it's all relevant.
Their kits are made of recycled plastic or something.
Kale. It's the first kale kit.
They are embroiled in a planning wrangle, to use the journalistic vernacular, over their new sort of stadium, which is largely, I think, largely made of wood.
Right. Ply scrapers are obviously the new thing. Yeah. So,
but as well, I suppose there must. You mentioned the impact on the travel network. Sustainability for new stadium locations must be a really major issue.
Especially in London, obviously, and especially if you're interacting with something like the London Stadium. I think a much more positive take on the impact of planning and football is the new Luton Stadium, which we are acting on. The planning permission hasn't been issued yet, but I did have a look through the committee report, which is a large document.
When the planning permission was announced, that the director or the owner or whoever it was described it as the greatest day in the history of Luton town, and I can still remember them lifting a trophy in the 80s.
But obviously not. Well, that was one of the, when I was looking through.
I mean, you can still remember.
Yes. Though actually, I wasn't a football supporter in the 80s. Yes, I'm afraid. Recent convert. I think one of the things I really noticed about that, you know, you go through a planning committee report and you wait for the list of objections, the problems. And there's a paragraph here that says there were 62 letters of objection, 80 anonymous letters, again, sign of the times, but also 8,727 letters of support. I've personally, in all my years, never seen a stat like that on a planning application. And then there's a wonderful section where they talk about the benefits of the stadium beyond the football, which is obviously employment generation and economic benefits. But then they talk about the community benefits, and that is absolutely, really significant. The way in which it contributes to the local area, the money it puts in, the charity activities. It's just, you know, it's so much more than I'd expected. And also there's a brilliant bit in the report where they go through all these scenarios of what might or might not happen. And actually Luton are doing really well now.
So, they're in the championship.
That's right, yeah.
Seem to have started relatively brightly, I think.
Yeah. I love the commentary on the first match from Middlesbrough, where they drew 3-3, and there was a brilliant commentary. It said, for Graham Jones and Jonathan Woodgate, overseeing their first matches as managers, it was in turns delightful and agonising. That sounds like a planning committee. neither grumbled. That doesn't sound like a planning committee. Both proclaiming themselves happy with their team's ambitious play. Now, again, not like a planning committee. But, no, it's nice to see that and to promote that side of football, because football, often you see only from the perspective of the very overpaid players and making a lot of money and a lot of, you know, bad talk within the papers and various contentious issues. But at the grassroots level, they really are a very valuable contribution to the community generally. So, yes, go football.
And are there any other issues you wanted to highlight?
Well, I think stats and football go hand in hand, don't they? And VAR, obviously, is the technological revolution that's changing everything about football. But I think modern stadia are also leading the way with smart buildings. And as with all things technological, that is both a huge opportunity and a massive risk. And between setting this podcast up and coming in today, the Argent development at King's Cross has got itself in the news on the use of facial recognition.
It has. So have Manchester City. I believe.
Saw that, yes. And I, you know, when I was getting ready for today, I looked at the proposals for the redevelopment of Camp Nou, where they're using
Barcelona's
that
famous
for anybody
stadium.
That's listening that doesn't know that's Barcelona. this is the other link so between Ipswich and Barca. Because that Ipswich case, as well as the EIA point, one of the points they raised was whether or not it breached Article 8 of the Human Rights Act, which is the right to peaceful enjoyment of land and property. And Article 8 is exactly the part of the human rights agenda that is being investigated in terms of data and breaches of privacy. And there's actually a joint committee in Parliament on at the moment. Well, it's not on at the moment because they're in recess. But they've had all their evidence, which is some of it is somewhere between fascinating and scary. And they are currently in the middle of an inquiry on whether the collection and use and storage of data is a threat to human rights. And this is, you know, this is where Argent fell foul in the King's Cross, or may have fallen foul in the King's Cross development. It's where people are making a club like Man City sit up and think about what are we using this data for. So I think that's the key with data. It's really easy to just sort of say it's absolutely fantastic, or to say it must be banned. And either way, I think you miss out on the spectrum. And I was listening to Digital Planet this morning, and they were talking about data. They were talking about data scraping. They were talking about facial recognition. And they both made the point that while they see that you need to regulate data, you can't stop it happening. And they were talking about a continuum of consent, and I like that idea. But so I think we're no longer free to simply harvest data, and anybody who's building a building has got to think about unintended consequences as well as the intended ones when it comes to data. And someone like Man City, where they're trialling a system that will use facial recognition to let fans through the gates really quickly. Of course we all want that. Yeah. You know, it will reduce congestion, it will mitigate that planning impact. But you don't want to do that at the price of creating a human rights issue. So I can see a situation where if you want to take advantage of that free flow, you're going to have to consent to it in advance. But if you don't consent, there will have to be another gate. And all, not just property people involved in football, anyone involved with property now has to consider what, not just what they are consciously using data for, but what is their building capable of generating autonomously, because autonomous data is special category data. And you know, if you say to people, or you know, your average 14-year-old, would you like to take part in a virtual training session with your heroes at Man City? Of course they'll say yes. And I might not want to do that, but I'd certainly do if it was Steve Bruce. I think I could out-train Steve Bruce with confidence. I can say this, I think. So even I might sign up for something like that. But if you said, oh, you know, here's a whole load of under 14-year-olds. Yeah. We're going to take their names, their emails, their addresses, and their biometric data. That becomes a completely different proposition. And it's the same proposition. It's just that you have, you know, one of them's the very much the kind of cautious approach to data, and the other one is promoting it. Yeah. And we have to, if we're now developing properties, think of a way of a middle ground that takes care of the risks, but still allows us the benefits of data use and the benefits of technology. And I hope Man City are able to find a way to do that. Because I think, you know, that the future's coming whether we want it or not, and there are ways of working around it.
And I imagine the legal system will have to evolve very quickly to deal with a lot of these concerns.
Well, I know predictions are all part of the planning, and I'd like to say that Arsenal will make top four this year. I'm not going any further than that. But I think I will predict that, you know, this time next year, things like data impact assessments will be part of the planning process. Yep. I can't see a way where we won't be dealing with data, and I think something like a data impact assessment will be the way of doing it. So there's my prediction for the future.
Well, something that might complicate the process even further.
Well, it wouldn't be planning if it wasn't complicated.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Sue, and for offering us some football talking points that don't involve handball or offside.
I would like to say when Shearer and co start saying it's the law that's wrong, they're actually talking about regulations by a professional sporting body, not the law. It's my personal peeve. I just like, it's not the law, guys. It's just a set of regulations. So yes, thanks, Jess. That's really useful.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And for talking such a good game.
Thank you.